Welcome to The Swing,
Canadian political analysis for global audiences. I'm Yaroslav Baran.
And I'm Heather Bakken. Today we're going to talk about the return of Parliament, Canada has a budget date, a familiar face bids farewell, and Albania appointed AI. Yaroslav, let's start with what's current and happening here at home in Canada. We have a new parliament. It's just kicked off. Question period was really interesting. Can you talk about the new dynamics we're facing there?
Yeah, the main difference between now and the spring is that we've got both the prime minister and the opposition leader in the House of Commons. Pre-election, the prime minister was not in the House. Post-election, this past spring, the opposition leader was not in the House. So now they're both back. They're both back in their normal seats, and they're squaring off daily in question period. So I suppose we could call it a normalization of Parliament, where we're going to see two adversaries duking it out on a daily basis.
Okay, I'd like you to dig into that a little bit more on the tonality, because yesterday, from my observation, it started off very cordial. There are a few spicy moments in there. What's your take on where this is going?
Yeah, I saw the same thing. I think we're seeing a slightly different tone now from the leader of the opposition. He's been, often criticized for being too much of an attack dog. I mean, fairly or unfairly, I don't know. It's the opposition leader's job to be an attack dog. But, nonetheless, he has been criticized for that. So yesterday we saw a little bit more of a statesman-like tone. And we're seeing a new dynamic whereby the critics are being the attack dogs on an issue-specific basis. We'll see if that holds, but so far it's a little bit different.
Do you think there is a genuine change of tone, or is this just testing the waters to see what works, what could be more effective? What's your take on that?
I think that we're going to see constant experimentation. The opposition is going to be experimenting with different approaches. And at the same time, on the government side, we saw a little bit of rustiness over the last couple of days in question period. The prime minister is still learning his role. He's learning how to perform. He stumbled a few times. Other ministers they're not quite, back in the game yet. So both sides are going to be experimenting in style and approach a bit.
Can you explain the significance of question period for listeners who maybe don't quite have the knowledge that you have?
Yeah, a question period is a daily phenomenon in the House of Commons let me take a step back. For most of the day, there aren't too many people in the House of Commons. You've got committees meeting, you've got all kinds of meetings going on, conferences, whatever. But for 45 minutes every day, it's a command performance. Everybody is in the House, everybody from the government, everybody from the opposition. And it's an aggressive 30-second question, 30-second answer, rapid fire of the opposition hurling questions at the government on anything and everything they can imagine to keep the government on its toes. So it's been kind of criticized or critiqued as simultaneously the most useless and the most useful part of the day. Useless in that nothing actually gets done. You're not advancing legislation. You're not voting on anything. You're not moving any issues forward from a technical kind of point of view. On the other hand, it's the one part of the day that gets media attention. And given Parliament's theoretical role of challenging the government and keeping the government clean, transparency and accountability, it is arguably the most important part of the day. Because the government, in preparing for question period, has to be prepared to account for any issue under its jurisdiction. Every minister needs to know everything going on in their portfolio, not just know it, but have an answer for everything.
What do you think the top issues are going to be this term?
Well, in terms of policy, the government is focusing a lot on housing and its new major projects office to fast-track infrastructure. But in Parliament, it may be a little bit different. And a lot of that additional stuff is largely going to be happening in committees. And committees are going to be probably one of the more interesting theaters in this Parliament rather than the floor of the House of Commons itself.
How is it organized, in terms of who has the levers of power within those committees, and what are the outcomes or the result of that?
Yeah, well, by and large, House of Commons committees consist of 10 people. But given the outcome of the election, committee representation is supposed to mirror the proportions of the seats on the floor of the House. So you got 10-person committees, five liberal and five opposition. But by and large, the chairs are liberal. So in terms of voting members, the government is outnumbered. If the conservatives and the Bloc Québécois cooperate, if they can
cooperate. That's because a chair doesn't vote.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. So if the opposition parties can cooperate, they will command committees. So that means that they can really drive an agenda of their choosing to embarrass the government, to whatever it is that they want to do to keep the government clean, to challenge, to poke and prod. So it's going to be, committees are not going to be a very pleasant and fun area of parliamentary work for the government.
What are the standout committees for you? What's going to dominate parliament this session?
Well, finance committee is going to be pretty hot for the next several weeks. We know when the federal budget is going to be tabled.
November 4th, and you got it right. You did it on the swing.
I'll take that win. Yeah, I suggest that it was going to slip to November. But the finance committee is going to be hot because it's going to be basically spend all its time between now and then doing a pre-budget consultation. They're going to hear from countless stakeholders on what ought to be in the budget. It's an annual cyclical thing that they do, and it's pretty high profile. Other committees, the International Trade Committee is going to be really hot as well, given the prominence of the trade file these days. Tariff wars, sure. We've got certain sectors being really hard hit by tariffs. We've got a proactive trade diversification agenda, so there's really a lot for them to chew on. National Defense Committee is also probably going to be pretty hot. There's a lot happening there. There's a lot of money going into the armed forces this year and beyond. There is currently a fighter jet procurement review underway. There is a submarine procurement decision around the corner. They'll probably want to talk about how the Canadian Armed Forces are doing in terms of recruitment. So lots and lots for them to chew on. And probably, you know, the last one I'd single out is transport. They've already sunk their teeth into a bit of a scandal or a scandalette, a controversy over the federal government backstopping and financing a procurement of Chinese manufactured ferries for British Columbia. So that's caused a little bit of discomfort given Canada's chilly relations with China for good reason, and B, self-declared by Canadian policy for government procurement. So it's a bit of an uncomfortable situation there. Also, if you look back at some of the hotter topics of the summer, there was a very significant Air Canada strike that stranded over 500,000 passengers.
It did change plans for a lot of people.
Yeah. And so since that was such a big issue over the summer, I will be surprised if the Transport Committee doesn't take up the issue of, you know, air passenger rights. Should you be entitled to redress when your flights are canceled and you're stranded and you need to make your own way home and that sort of thing? I'll be stunned if they don't take that up as a study issue. And, you know, committees are powerful beasts. They have theoretically unfettered authority to compel people or papers. They effectively have power of subpoena. So a lot of interesting things can happen in parliamentary committees.
Is there any hot spot there in terms of who could be subpoenaed?
Well, it all depends on the study. Basically, right now, all the committees are getting together and planning their business for the season.
Okay. I mean,
some of them, we know what they're working on, like transport and finance, but, you know, others are out there mapping out their plans as we speak.
Speaking of transportation, our Minister of Transportation and Internal Trade, Chrystia Freeland, resigned. And she announced that she's going to be a special envoy to Ukraine, and particularly in reconstruction. This is your wheelhouse, too. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a very good appointment. She has very deep relationships there and internationally on the Ukraine subject. She's built relationships with cabinet ministers all over the world. She's attended various fora and conferences on the war and the post-war situation. So I can't think of a stronger person, frankly, at the prime minister's disposal to put into that kind of a role. It does leave a hole in an A-list portfolio, though, in transport. So that's going to have to be filled.
Yeah, and what is there's a procedure when this happens, right? Like, who steps in on her behalf?
In a bit of a little known, you know, behind the scenes cabinet, you know, infrastructure, there's a process whereby after a cabinet is sworn in, an order in council is issued formally designating a backup minister for every portfolio. So in the event of incapacitation or death or resignation.
Designated survivor.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. No, it's an automatic backup. So you get hit by a bus, you resign, you're unfit for duty for any reason. There's automatically a backup pre-designated for each portfolio. In this case, when transport becomes vacant, Joel Lightbound, the Minister of Government Transformation, Public Works and Procurement, automatically becomes the acting transport minister until further notice, until the Prime Minister formalizes it with a permanent designation.
The timing is very interesting on Chrystia Freeland. We had a salon last night, actually, where we invited the member of European Parliament from Latvia, Reince Posnecks. Can you just share some of what the insights were? Because I thought the conversation was really interesting, and it does relate back to the fight that Ukraine is in, our fight for democracy, our Western values, what Canada's role is, where allies are, what situation right now we're in with security and defense.
Yeah, it's really a confluence of two things, the effects of the war, and Europe has really woken up. Europe is really getting its act together and very quickly reindustrializing in terms of its defense industrial capabilities and mapping new supply chains in defense. At the same time, we've got everything happening with the States, with tariffs generating a trade diversification imperative with for all U.S. trading partners. That includes the EU, that includes Canada, that includes others. So witness, for example, the announcement by the Prime Minister that Canada started discussions to join the Rearm Europe network coalition. The big question for me in this is how effectively will or can Canada integrate into the European defense procurement system? Will anything change, or is it symbolic? Because, by instinct, most countries buy domestically for defense. France tends to buy French. Germany tends to buy German. There's no pan-EU defense procurement system. The procurement is done by sovereign countries, and they tend to favor their own industries. So
sounds like Canada and our federation with provinces and territories in a way. We are a federation, but we also have these internal differences and areas of expertise.
Yeah, but at least in Canada, within our federation, it's typically been the case that, say, the auto industry tends to be an Ontario thing. Aerospace tends to be a Quebec thing. Oil and gas tends to be an Alberta thing.
Yeah.
But in Europe, you've got a French defense sector, you've got a German defense sector, you've got a Swedish defense sector, and on and on.
Right,
and sovereign governments, if they have to spend billions on defense, will naturally favor their own countries. So time will tell if that will change or if it's a whole bunch of goodwill and symbolism about diversification of supply chains and defense, but nothing really changes in the end.
It's interesting because the takeaway I had, and we had business community leaders and people from the defense industry, and it's always Chatham House rule. But one of the big takeaways that I learned from the discussion was that we probably need to be more nimble, by we, I mean the West, and engage private investment, civil society, in defense and security, manufacturing and procurement and all that stuff. Did you note a change there? Was that of any significance to you, that part of it?
Yeah, we are seeing nimbleness already internationally, but again, we risk getting stuck in this sort of awkward intersection of two separate imperatives. One is diversification of supply chains, and the other one is protectionism. And protectionism in trade is one thing. It tends to be something new by and large, but in the defense sector, protectionism has always been there. So what and how much is actually going to be changing?
Ukraine has been a great model for that, though.
Yeah, in particular drones. Ukraine is leading in drone technology, and they are now the country to partner with, because they're at the cutting edge of the latest in tech.
And they're manufacturing their own drones now.
Yeah, and increasingly equipping them with AI.
That reminds me, Albania had a very interesting appointment. They have now a minister. that is AI.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a funny thing. When I first heard, you know, when I first heard this, I thought, well, wait a second. What do you mean Albania is the first government to have an AI minister?
We have an AI minister.
We have one, Seven Solomon. But no, then I realized, no. This is a minister who is AI, not responsible for AI.
Yeah.
And, you know, I gather the idea there is to take corruption entirely out of government procurement and have all procurement decisions being done by a machine, artificial intelligence that is supposed to be bribe-proof, corruption-proof, etc.
So lobbyists are not going to be able to get an appointment with Daela, as she's known in the native languages, which means sun, by the way. So I guess they're shedding some light on the corruption. But no, I can't have an ask for this.
Yeah, well, or corruption going forward is not going to be bags of cash. It's going to be via hackers. Trying to hack the system. So we'll see if this experiment works.
On that note, I think we stay tuned and we can report back on Daela if necessary. But there's going to be a lot more to talk about in the coming weeks with the House sitting right now.
Yeah, final note on Daela and Albania. There were some voices in Albania saying this is just the first step and they look forward to someday in the future when they have an AI prime minister. I'm not sure I'm ready for that step, but you know, hey, fill your boots if that's your thing.
Well, I think Goethe addressed this back in the Romantic period with the sufferings of young Goethe. Stay with me here. It was a book that came out after Frankenstein, basically freaked out the literary world, where it became fashionable for some young women at dinner parties to faint to prove they weren't automatons. So Frankenstein unleashed this whole notion that we could create human automatons. And so if we went to a dinner party with our friends, nobody really knew who was real and who was artificial.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. No, this is a real thing. It's one of the few classes I paid attention to at university. So the young ladies would faint, and then you prove they weren't it. So I feel we're kind of in that moment now with AI and virtual reality, where maybe the Prime Minister of Canada or of any country will have to start doing and saying things that proves they're real. What say you? Maybe fainting question period.
To be continued.
Well, hopefully we'll see you next week, Yaroslav. Thanks very much for your insight.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.